Welcome to the Anesthesiology Journal podcast, an audio interview of study authors and editorialists.
Hello, I'm Jim Rathmel, professor of anesthesia at Harvard Medical School and chair of the Department of Anesthesiology, Perioperative and Pain Medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital. I'm one of the editors for Anesthesiology, and you're listening to an anesthesiology podcast that we've designed for physicians and scientists interested in the research that appears in the journal. Today, we're going to talk with one of the authors of an original research article and the author of an accompanying editorial that appear in the July 2022 issue. With us today is Dr. Shiro Isono. Dr. Isono is professor and chair of the Department of Anesthesiology, Pain, and Palliative Care Medicine in the Graduate School of Medicine at Chiba University in Chiba, Japan. Dr. Isono is the senior author on an article that appears in the July 2022 issue of the journal titled Combination Therapy of High-Flow Nasal Cannula and Upper Body Elevation for Postoperative Sleep Disordered Breathing, Randomized Crossover Trial. Dr. Isono, thank you for joining us.
Hello, Jim. Thank you very much for inviting me to participate in the podcast. I'm very much pleased to be with you today.
Also with us today is Dr. David Hillman. Dr. Hillman is clinical professor in the Center for Sleep Science at the University of Western Australia, Sir Charles Gairdner Hospital in Nedlands, Australia. Dr. Hillman authored an editorial that accompanies Dr. Isono's original research article in the July 2022 issue of the journal titled, Is CPAP All There Is? Alternative Perioperative Treatments for Obstructive Sleep Apnea. Dr. Hillman, welcome and thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Jim. It's great to be with you and with Shiro to discuss this important topic.
All right, so we're going to use first names today. Shiro, congratulations on the publication of your study. Let's start with a little background. We know that obstructive sleep apnea, or OSA, is an independent risk factor for postoperative respiratory and cardiovascular complications. We also know that continuous positive airway pressure, or CPAP, decreases the frequency of OSA. So why do we need alternatives to CPAP?
Thank you, Jim. The question may be better addressed by David later, but that is the essential question and the motivation of our study. Let me talk our experience here in Japan. In our hospital, we routinely performed OSA screening with stopband questionnaire and diagnosed OSA with a portable sleep study for all surgical patients before surgery. When severe OSA is identified, we prescribe CPAP, of course, a gold standard for OSA treatment. But most patients don't prefer to use it. In fact, the CPAP acceptance rate in surgical patients is reported to be as low as 30%. So currently, we are able to find undiagnosed OSA patients preoperatively, but we do not have validated effective OSA treatment options in a real clinical world. This is the motivation of our study and the reason why we need alternatives to CPAP.
You looked at the combination of supplemental oxygen administered using a high-flow nasal cannula combined with upper body elevation to see if this would improve postoperative OSA. What was the original hypothesis of your study?
Based on previous studies for OSA patients visiting sleep clinics, we already knew that each of the high-flow nasal cannula or upper body elevation is effective for OSA improvement. However, the effects of each intervention is relatively small compared to CPAP because the mechanisms of the interventions are possibly different from each other. We consider that the combination of the interventions would be additive and be clinically applicable. Therefore, our original hypothesis of this study was to whether the combination of high-flow nasal cannula and upper body elevation additively improves frequency of apneas and hypopneas during sleep.
Tell us how the study was conducted.
Okay, the study was designed as non-blinded randomized crossover trial in our university hospital. We repeated portable sleep studies with nasal airflow and pulse oximetry 4 times before and immediately after surgery, with different combinations of the high-flow nasal cannula therapy and upper body elevation. Participants slept on a flat bed in one preoperative night at home. Now, this is a control study. In another preoperative night after admission, they slept on a bed with 30-degree head-of-bed elevation. These preoperative sleep studies were performed without high-flow nasal cannula. And post-operative sleep studies were performed with high-flow nasal cannula at a flow rate of 20 liters per minute with 40% oxygen concentration. But the order of the angles of the head of bed was randomly determined, either flat angle first or 30-degree head of bed elevation first. 19 patients completed studies, while all sleep studies were completed in 15 patients. We performed full analysis for these 19 patients. We measured frequency of apneas and hypopneas during the sleep studies and assessed effectiveness of each intervention and the combination for improving the apnea and hypopnea frequency. Statistical analysis was performed by a linear mixed effect model for flow-based apnea-hypopnea index, accounting for interventions such as high-flow nasal cannula, 30-degree head-of-bed elevation, and their combination as a fixed effect, and subject as a random effect while adjusting time and order. Is it clear how we conducted the study?
Yeah, so this was a non-blinded, randomized crossover study performed at a single university hospital examining the effect of modified apnea-hypopnea index that was based exclusively on the airflow signal without arterial oxygen saturation criteria, a so-called flow-based apnea-hypopnea index that you use for your primary outcome. What did you learn?
We learned a lot. First of all, the mixed effect model analysis estimated a significant independent effect of high-flow nasal cannula, 30-degree head-of-bed elevation, and their combination on the decrease of their flow-based apnea-hypopnea index. Second, clinically most important, the combination decreased flow-based apnea-hypopnea index by 23 events per hour from the control 60 events per hour. We consider the 38% reduction of abnormal breathing is a clinically meaningful effect. Third, effects of upper body elevation was limited to improvement of OSA frequency, whereas high-flow nasal cannula had a significant effect on both improvement of nocturnal hypoxemia and OSA frequency. Now, finally, I would like to mention that all participants except one accepted high-flow nasal cannula therapy throughout the night. This is a significant contrast to CPAP treatment. Although we did not aim to assess the acceptance of the treatment in this study.
Were there any limitations to your study?
Oh, yes. There are several significant limitations in this study. First of all, we did not perform polysomnogram, and therefore the flow-based apnea-hypopnea index used as the primary outcome may possibly be influenced due to differences of sleep efficiency during the study period. I consider future studies need to reassess our findings using polysomnography technique. Another important limitation is the complexity of the study design and incomplete set of sleep studies. It was difficult to eliminate inferences of potential effects of the odor and the combination of interventions on the primary outcome. However, we consider this was well handled by the mixed effect model for full analysis set in this study. Finally, although this is not the scope of our study, we did not assess dose responsiveness of the high flow nasal cannula and upper body elevation. We only assessed a single pattern of the combination. For clinical application, we think we need to determine optimal levels of each intervention.
So what did you conclude?
We conclude that the combination of high-flow nasal cannula therapy and 30-degree upper body elevation effectively improves OSC severity and nocturnal oxygenation. Its performance for OSA treatment is inferior to CPAP therapy, but may be considered as an alternative postoperative airway management strategy, particularly when CPAP is refused or is unsuitable for other reasons.
David, I want to turn to your editorial that accompanies Shiro's original research article. It's also in the July 2022 issue of the journal, and it's titled, "Is CPAP All There Is? Alternative Perioperative Treatments for Obstructive Sleep Apnea." You do a terrific job of putting Shiro's article into perspective and explaining what we know about current alternatives to CPAP. Can you start by telling us about the prevalence of obstructive sleep apnea and its impact during the perioperative period?
Yes, it's very common. Moderate to severe obstructive sleep apnea, that is sleep apnea with 15 or more partial or complete upper airway obstructions per hour of sleep, affects about 13% of adult men and 6% of adult women. Now, sex, body, weight, and age are strong influences. So, for example, in men over 50 years with a body mass index of over 40 kilograms per meter squared, the percentage with moderate to severe obstructive sleep apnea climbs to 56%. In women of equivalent age and weight, 33% have it. Reflecting these factors, a recent Canadian study suggested 38% of patients presenting for surgery have moderate to severe obstructive sleep apnea. About 70% were in the severe range, that is, they had more than 30 partial or complete obstructions per sleep hour. Compounding this, it's a grossly underdiagnosed condition. Approximately 85% of obstructive sleep apnea patients remain undiagnosed. Many of this avalanche of cases will present without a diagnosis for surgery. As for its perioperative impacts, principal amongst these are substantially increased risks of cardiac death, myocardial injury, heart failure, new onset atrial fibrillation, unplanned admissions to ICU, and unplanned intubation and ventilation.
Now, I think once you've seen a CPAP device, the answer to my next question is obvious, but can you tell us what is it about CPAP that makes it hard for patients to comply with?
Well, it can be a bit confronting, even when there are compelling reasons to use it. Because of this, it's vital that hospital staff understand it, can troubleshoot problems with it, and are strong advocates for it. Now, the main problems patients find with CPAP are mask discomfort and air leakage, which is really annoying if it's into the eyes, its intrusiveness and inconvenience, airway drying with dry mouth and nasal irritation, often a sensation of pressure with trouble exhaling, often because with early use there's a tendency to want to exhale back down to normal functional residual capacity rather than to accept the elevated FRC that accompanies therapy. Familiarity and explanation can help here. Another problem is with air swallowing. The barrier pressure of the lower esophageal sphincter is about 20 centimeters of water, so this is a problem particularly at higher airway pressures. Another problem is noise. With some patients, there's the problem of involuntary removal during sleep, even though they accept it during wakefulness. And, of course, body image and pride are confronted by it. Now, these issues are all amenable to relief if there's a will to persist.
So what's your interpretation of Shiro's results? Is this new treatment with high-flow nasal cannula and upper body elevation suitable alternative to CPAP?
Shiro's team's shown a definite treatment benefit with this combination of high-flow oxygen and 30% bedhead elevation. There's an almost fourfold reduction in the number of apneas, that is, total obstructions, per hour of sleep with these measures. However, the number of partial obstructions, or hypopneas, remains fairly constant, no doubt because potential apneas have become hypopneas at the top end, as potential hypopneas are resolved at the lower end. Hence, it's a helpful treatment. It appears capable of obviating the need for CPAP in some cases, perhaps many cases, and it should certainly be considered where, despite reasonable effort, the gold standard CPAP treatment cannot be used because of difficulties with implementation, including the patient refusal issues that Shira referred to.
In your editorial, you review a whole range of alternatives to CPAP. Can you briefly go over the most prominent amongst them and comment on the relative effectiveness of each of these approaches?
Well, there are several potential alternatives for perioperative use, although most of them are yet to be formally investigated in this perioperative setting, and they should be. They include other positional therapies besides bedhead elevation, such as sleeping in the lateral position rather than supine, and neck extension as opposed to flexion. Supine sleep more than doubles OSA severity in 60% of OSA patients, and in 20% of OSA patients, the OSA only occurs when supine. So lateral sleep is a good idea. Another area is oral appliances that advance the mandible, that is, produce jaw thrust. They're in widespread successful use for OSA treatment, and really are, it's become the treatment of choice for milder forms of sleep apnea, and certainly a second-line treatment for more severe sleep apnea not amenable to CPAP therapy. The best of these devices are made to measure and take time to construct, and so are not suitable for perioperative introduction, but there are off-the-shelf boil-and-bite variants that are also widely available, and they're getting better and better. It's time we looked at these systematically for perioperative use. There are also oropharyngeal and nasopharyngeal devices that deserve exploration. These are, of course, essential aids in the early postoperative period. They seem a bit intrusive for later use. However, there has been some success in using less intrusive nasal stents for home treatment of obstructive sleep apnea, and these need to be explored for perioperative purposes. Tracheostomy has got to be mentioned. While its use is going to be rare and temporary, it must be considered where severe postoperative upper airway compromise is anticipated, for example, after extensive airway surgery. The other things that anesthesiologists can do is to exercise caution with the use of drugs that potentially aggravate OSA, such as opioids, hypnotics, and sedatives. This is an important management principle, and of course, use of these drugs needs to be reduced or ceased or substituted for where OSA proves problematic postoperatively. Unfortunately, as yet, there are no reliable drug treatments to treat obstructive sleep apnea itself, although this is a challenge that various groups have grappled with over the years. One aim of such therapies would be to activate upper airway dilator muscles during sleep to a similar degree to that present during wakefulness, because, of course, during wakefulness, we don't snore or obstruct. Other ways of stimulating upper airway dilator muscles, such as implanted hypoglossal nerve stimulators, are in successful use in the sleep medicine world, and a future possibility may be a transcutaneous method of producing the same effect.
What's the take-home message for practicing anesthesiologists? When should we use the new technique described in Shiro's paper or any of the other alternatives for CPAP for patients with OSA in the perioperative period?
Well, prompt and assured return of arousal responses that protect against prolonged periods of upper airway obstruction is a key objective of early postoperative management of OSA. Where OSA is problematic postoperatively, but circumstances permit, it's perfectly reasonable to try Shiro's technique and the other measures we've discussed in the first instance and assess response to them. However, where there are persistent problems, then CPAP treatment must be considered, and it's very important that it's properly understood, advocated for, and implemented by attendant hospital staff. If it proves CPAP cannot be used for one reason or another, then Dr. Asono's technique and these other measures certainly merit further consideration.
Shiro, what comes next for you and your research group?
Thank you, Jim, and thank you. Very positive comment on our research, David. Our research group has been focusing mechanisms of OSA and perioperative OSA management. As to this highlighted study, we performed an endoscopy study at the same time. We assessed how the pharyngeal airway patency is influenced by the combination of high-flow nasal cannula and upper body elevation in the same participant and the general anesthesia before surgery. We are currently analyzing the data and will submit the paper to anesthesiology, and hopefully you will accept again. We are also developing a non-contact respiratory monitoring system for assessments of respiratory rate and respiratory patterns, such as obstructive apnea. As you know, patients respond to the treatment differently, so therefore we need to manage them individually. Wires and cables of current patient monitoring system are not suitable for this purpose. We succeeded in accurately capturing a respiratory signal from four load cells placed under the bed legs and reported some promising data in Journal of Applied Physiology. We are hoping that this non-contact, unconstrained bed sensor respiratory monitor will contribute to improvement of post-operative respiratory management in the near future.
Well, that's terrific. I hope today's discussion will lead many of you listening to read this new article in the accompanying editorial view that appear in the July 2022 issue of Anesthesiology, where you can learn more about alternatives to CPAP for patients with obstructive sleep apnea. Doctors Holly Endy and John Wanderer from Vanderbilt created an infographic titled Airway Openers, Alternatives to CPAP, that summarizes the findings of this study and the editorial. Shiro, David, thank you for joining me today and for the terrific explanations.
Thanks, Jim.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Anesthesiology Journal Podcast, the official peer-reviewed journal of the American Society of Anesthesiologists. Check anesthesiology.org for an archive of this podcast and other related content.